You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of January 2018 on Monocle 24. This is Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One in London. I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan. Coming up, integration is good for business. That's the message the French president will take with him to Davos next week. But as France moves forward, will Italy turn back the clock by re-embracing Silvio Berlusconi? My guests Marie Bion and Alistair Bunkle will be discussing Europe's appetite for change and the day's other top stories, including...
We are very excited and thrilled. It'll be like a breath of fresh air walking down Riverside Boulevard, not being embarrassed by the Trump dump name.
As residents of a Trump-branded property look to have the president's name removed from the building's facade, we'll take a closer look at branding in American politics. And we'll find out why crowdsourcing ideas might be just a ticket for New York's Transport Authority. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Henry Rees-Sheridan. Welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Marie Bion, UK correspondent for French media, and Alistair Bunkle, defence correspondent for Sky News. Welcome both to the programme. What to make of Europe in 2018 with Macron's victory in France and Mark Rutte's in the Netherlands? It looked for a minute like Europe was wrapping itself in a centrist blanket following the Brexit vote. But then came gains for the Alternative for Deutschland party in Germany and the victory of Andrej Babiš in the Czech Republic. What the continent is left with is not so much a cosy blanket as an itchy patchwork quilt. The Europeans are agitated is clear, but what do they want exactly? France and Italy offer a study in contrasts. French President Emmanuel Macron is expected to deliver a pro-Europe speech at Davos later this month with a focus on greater European integration and the benefits it can bring for business. But in Italy, polls ahead of March's election show voters warming to both a right-wing coalition fronted by Silvio Berlusconi and the left-wing populism of the Eurosceptic five-star movement. Why are appetites for change in France and Italy taking such different paths? Marie, let's begin with you. Update us on what reforms Macron has got through so far and how they've been received.
So the first big reform that he's started with was the labour law reform. It didn't start very well. He wanted basically to liberalise the working state of France and make it more easier to fire someone than to hire someone, and perhaps taking a bit of power from the union somehow. And it didn't go down well. There were a lot of people in the street not happy about that, saying that he was an elitist president, not talking about the workers and all that. Now he's going ahead with the second agenda, which is trying to break down the deficit of France. That's going to be something that's less close to the heart of the French people. So he might get a bit, easier on him, basically. Although, as well, because it's going to tackle the question of the health service as well in terms of deficit. That's a big part of it, and that's something that people want to remain to have it still working. So, first phase was the hardest one. Was really the hardest one. Now it's not going to be plain sailing, but it's going to be a bit smoother.
Alistair, turning our attention to Italy, as I mentioned in the introduction, the two parties getting on best ahead of the election next month seem to be a right-wing coalition headed perhaps unexpectedly by Silvio Berlusconi, and on the left, a populist insurgent movement, the Five Star Movement. How can we interpret this? What does it say about what Italians want?
I'm not sure how you can interpret Silvio Berlusconi's resurgence. I mean, after his after being found guilty and serving nominally time in prison, and the fact that those charges mean that he, I believe, wouldn't be able to stand actually in Parliament or sit in Parliament, albeit in theory he could still be the country's next Prime Minister, which would be his fifth term as Prime Minister, I think. And yet, this man who's now well into his 80s and has become even a caricature of himself is in pole position again to lead the country. And I sort of imagine in Brussels they're not too pleased about that, because Italy needs to see the sort of reforms that Macron is trying to push through in France. They tried, particularly under Matteo Renzi, But I think Italians were not seeing the benefits of those reforms quickly enough, and they grew impatient. And that is why you've had, what, four leaders, or once this election is done, you'll have had four different leaders of Italy in the last 5 years.
Marie, turning back to France, Macron's expected to be this year's rock star at Davos. He'll be addressing an audience hot on integration and free trade. Will his pitch there be different to his pitch to voters in France? And if so, how?
Well, globalisation is something that, of course, Davos is all about, whereas in France, globalisation is something that's not universally liked, of course, like in every country. So he might like to perhaps dial it down a bit when he talks about the same thing in France. But still, the idea that France is back on the world stage, back for good and influence things, is something that French people are basically quite happy about. So it depends the way he shows it, because as I said at the beginning, he's seen as an elitist president, the president for the rich, and globalization is seen as something that's better for the richer than for the poorer. So if he works the magic that he managed to work during the campaign, and he convinced people that globalization, some point down the line, is going to be good for even the average worker, it might go down well. But that's a very long shot.
Also, looking to Germany, so a different country within Europe, the coalition blueprint that was hashed out between Merkel's Conservative bloc and Martin Schulz's SPD last week calls for more European integration, particularly closer cooperation with France. But Alternative for Deutschland is still the third biggest party, even though people aren't talking about them as much anymore. The refugee crisis is still a reality in the country. Brexit is yet to come. Do you think there's a risk that by heralding centrist Europhilic gains as triumphs, analysts and politicians could lose sight of the severity of the problems that caused the populist surge in the first place?
Yeah, because I think that AfD performed well in Germany, although not as well as probably they were expected to do about a year out from the elections. Then you've got the Five Star Movement in Italy that, again, is performing strongly. And then I suspect that if you were to, at the next round of French presidential elections in a few years' time, at the moment, you would probably gamble on Marine Le Pen, again, being quite a strong candidate in that. I mean, in fact, the theory goes is that she was using this round of elections sort of almost as a stepping stone to really go for the presidency in a few years' time. And so you have, within those three countries, you still have that underlying current. Angela Merkel has clearly been distracted by internal domestic politics, and that to some degree has hampered Macron, because I think Macron understandably sees Germany as his big ally to try and force through closer integration of Europe. Having now made some progress in Germany, it'll be interesting to see how close the two countries, France and Germany, and Merkel and Macron, come together now in this kind of united, concerted effort.
So, Marie, you know, we mentioned Le Pen's presidential run there. It ended up being disappointing compared to some projections. But to your mind, what's the state of the French far right going into 2018?
Well, at the moment, Le Pen and the Front National, because it's still the name of the party, is going not doing well, basically. They're trying to rebrand themselves, and they're trying to rebrand the name of the party, and Marine Le Pen is trying, well, not to rebrand herself, because she's already rebranded herself, being called Marine and not Marine Le Pen, dropping, you know, the last name of her father, which was a very far-right figure. She wants to be seen as a more, you know, round-edged figure. So at the moment, it's not going very, very, very well for her in terms of rebranding. In terms of what Macron is doing, well, she's the far right, but in terms of social issues, when it goes to, you know, labor law and this kind of thing, she's quite left on the scene, basically. So she was kind of against, and the party was kind of against what Macron was doing, which is can be quite hard to understand for people who think, oh, we have a far right party and that's how it's gonna go down. So at the moment, it's a bit difficult, but they still have four years to make up for it, and the rest of the opposition is absolutely non-existent. The center right has elected a new head a few weeks ago. It's trying to shape things up, but it takes in a bit of time. The center left is not doing well as well. So at the moment, the weakness of the Front National is seen by the fact that there's no one else shouting loud enough on the scene. But neither the center left, the centre-right, but not even the far-right.
Alistair, finally and briefly before we move on, how do you view British politics as fitting into the ideological political map of Europe?
A very good question. I think at the moment there isn't really an answer to that, because I think British politicians are trying to establish for themselves how they fit into Europe post-Brexit, because everything is seen through the prism of Brexit. And I think Europe is also trying to establish for itself how prepared it is to allow Britain to remain, or how close it will allow Britain to remain part of the wider European political scene. I think once the dust settles in a year or two's time, undoubtedly Britain will need to play a close part of any kind of any European political map. And I think that's what you'll see on Thursday when Macron is over here to meet Theresa May. I think there is an awareness for all the not insults, but for all this of criticisms that go back and forth over the channel to Brussels, to London, Paris, to London, etc. I think there is a realization that above it all, whether it be economic, financial integration or cooperation, whether it be military cooperation, defence and security, etc., that actually, Europe is better with Britain as a partner, and Britain is better with Europe as a partner. It's just about trying to find that middle line.
So there's an overview of politics in Europe. We're going to drill down now into one particular issue. It doesn't get as many headlines as it used to, but migration continues to be one of the main challenges facing Europe. Emmanuel Macron visited migrants in Calais today ahead of a visit to the UK on Thursday, as you just mentioned, where he will ask Theresa May to do more to help with the stranded population at the entrance to the Channel Tunnel. Marie, there are still hundreds of migrants living in and around Calais, despite the large camp known as the Jungle having been dismantled in 2016. What does Macron want from Britain?
Well, he wants two things, basically. He wants the UK to step up to the plate and take more unaccompanied migrants, because the minors, that's where they want to go. They want to go to the UK because they have family there, so they want the UK to do a bit more to basically look at the files and see if they are entitled to it, and if they are entitled to it, to basically welcome them to the UK, the first thing. The second thing is that they want better infrastructure in Calais, in Dunkirk, to be able to process and to control the migrants and the refugees, to be able to do the job a bit quicker. And so they want more money from the UK, because from the 2K Treaty from 2003, the effective border of the UK is in France. It's not in Dover, it's in Calais. And France, the government and the French people as well, consider that they're doing a favour to the UK by having the UK border in France, and that the UK should basically help a bit more. The idea that France is deciding what they need and UK only has to foot the bill is something that's being given in the UK, whereas in France, Macron is coming in 2 days' time to talk about that with Theresa May. This, what do you think we should do to improve the situation? It's not Macron saying, we want to do that, you have to pay for that. Macron in particular want to engage in more bilateral relationship with the UK concerning the migrants. It doesn't really help when the Daily Telegraph and the Daily Express said that Macron demands more money and that they strong arm London to give more money. It's a more progressive policy than that.
Alistair, will Theresa May's government be receptive to these suggestions?
Yes, up to a point. I think they are alarmed at some of what President Macron was saying in Calais today. And I think that they fear that there could be a little bit of a disagreement as to how much Britain should pay. I mean, I've covered the migrant crisis. I've been through the Jungle many times. I've been, and I've seen it in Turkey, I've seen it in Greece, I've seen it in the Mediterranean and on the Libyan border. You know, I don't think the migrant crisis is by any stretch something that has gone away. I think there might be a slight bit of sort of ennui within the press, but I think it still is an underlying root of many problems in Europe. And I do understand it from the French point of view, because, to put it bluntly, there's a complete mess around Calais a lot of the time. It is quite unsightly. I think this idea of moving the border to Britain, I just cannot see how that works. Because, I mean, how do you then propose the migrants get from Calais to said border in Britain safely and effectively? I don't know. And I think Britain has a point when it says, well, you know, the border should be pushed back and back. I mean, these migrants should never make their way into France in the first place. To cut a long story short, it is a shared problem, though. And Britain does need to be seen to be providing and giving as much as France does. I think the British do feel that they are doing that, though.
How are they currently doing that, to your mind?
Well, I'm just trying to find for you a press release that came out from the Home Office tonight in the UK. Here it is. A spokesman saying, we want to do all we can to make the border between the UK and France as secure as possible. And this will be one of the discussions when the two sides meet on Thursday. We've already invested in security fencing, CCTV and detection technology, but it is an ongoing process. So that's quite a defensive press release from the Home Office tonight, I think probably in response to what they've seen and heard from President Macron in Calais today.
Marie, leaving specific relations between France and the UK aside, France received 100,000 asylum claims last year. It was a record. It was one of the main destinations in Europe for asylum seekers. Macron is set to unveil a new migrant bill shortly. What's his vision for migrants in France?
He wants to be seen as welcoming, but welcoming in an effective way, basically. He wants, first of all, to try and control the flow of migrants more effectively. He wants to better the system of asylum claims review, and he wants to speed the process as well. That's something quite important for him, because he wants the refugee, those who are entitled to stay into the UK with a refugee status, to be able to be processed quickly and to be able to integrate into the French society quickly, because that's one of the main problem, and one of the main problem for the refugees, of course, but for the French public opinion as well. They think that refugees are a problem in France, whereas if they were helped a bit more, perhaps, to integrate, there would be less of a problem. That's what President Macron is saying. And at the same time, of course, it's give and take. Those who are not entitled to stay should be removed more rapidly and more effectively than they are today. So it's basically the carrot and the stick that he wants to put forward.
And Alistair, a lot of people think the Brexit vote was viewed by many as a referendum on immigration. Since the vote, has the UK come any closer to gaining more effective control over its borders?
No, not particularly. I don't think so. And I think it probably, if I'm being honest, didn't help that at the time of the Brexit referendum, you had those pictures provided by, you know, teams like me across Europe of long queues of migrants trying to make their way to Northern Europe. I mean, one thing I learned time and time again from reporting around the continent on the migrant crisis is that this idea that everybody wants to make their way to the Holy Land of Britain just is not true. I mean, people wanted to go across Europe, a lot of them. I mean, the majority of people I spoke to wanted to go to a place like Germany and Sweden. So it is a shared problem across Europe. And Marie, I mean, you do make the point, the headlines in this country that are not helpful to the debate. I assume, though, there must be equivalent headlines in France urging Macron to do more, to put more pressure on the Brits to help resolve this problem.
There is, yes, but it's more, I mean, we like to criticise our own before criticising the others. So I think there's more of a critic of Macron and the way he's dealing with things than the way the UK is dealing with the immigration issue, because it's a situation that's very local for France, in particular for the north of France. We sometimes pain to see that we have a partner in that, which is the UK, and that's exactly what Macron wants to emphasise. He wants to say, I've got things in my head, I'm trying to do something, but I have a partner partner with whom I had to deal with to be able to deal with the problem more efficiently. And that's something that's perhaps, I think, a little bit forgotten sometimes.
Well, you are listening to Midori House here with me, Henry Rees-Sheridan, Marie Bion and Alistair Bunkle. Coming up next, a resident's revolt in a Trump property. And can you crowdsource public infrastructure planning? This is Midori House. Stay tuned.
Our very own Monocle Library is growing into a robust collection of well-turned-out titles. For an in-depth look into our core theme of quality of life, why not delve into our first-ever book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living? For any would-be business leaders, entrepreneurs, or even established companies in search of fresh ideas, there's The Monocle Guide to Good Business. In How to Make a Nation, a Monocle Guide, we look at the small and the big things that can help make our nations work better. And in The Monocle Guide to Drinking and Dining, we bypass the foam and the fuss to uncover the makings of a truly great meal. Monocle's handsome books are published by our friends at Gestalten in Berlin and offer a world of new experiences between the covers. So spruce up your shelves today and buy some of our titles online at monocle.com or from any good bookstore.
You're listening to Midori House. Still with me are Marie Bion and Alistair Bunkle. Amid the daily PR battle being fought by Trump's White House, another war is underway involving one of the president's branded buildings. The condominium board for a 48-storey building overlooking the Hudson River filed a lawsuit last week asking permission to remove Donald Trump's name from the building if enough residents voted for the move. Alistair, it's a topsy-turvy world. Trump's political fortune was made in the Rust Belt, but his real estate fortune, of course, was made by aggressively acquiring large urban buildings facing foreclosure in the 70s and 80s, frequently putting his name on them. Having bought an apartment in a Trump building before Trump was president, is it a principled move to then attempt to remove his name from the building, or is it just a symptom of worrying too much about what the neighbours think?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. There's nothing wrong, in my opinion, that if your building is emblazoned with the name of someone who then goes on to become particularly controversial, and I think, you know, no one will disagree that Trump is at the very least controversial, then, and this is a democratic process, if enough people within that condominium vote to remove his name, then I see no problem with that, although it being America, it will get embroiled in lawsuit after lawsuit, and the only winners in the end will be the lawyers. I wouldn't be surprised if house prices within the building are affected by the fact that the name Trump is emblazoned on it, because he is so divisive nowadays.
No, they are. Apparently, I've got a stat here. Apparently, on a survey of 11 Trump-branded buildings in Manhattan, the average price per square foot, fell 7% in the 12 months through November, which is not inconsiderable when you consider the sums involved. Murray, this got me thinking. Trump's pre-existing brand was a really important component of his presidential run, and his ability to lean on it enabled him to pay apparently less than $5 per vote during his White House bid, about half of what Clinton paid. He may signal, you know, a way forward where candidates will rely more on social media presence, for example, pre-existing brands, than traditional fundraising to attain political office. If that is the case, wouldn't that be a more democratic system than we have at the moment? Because it's much easier to build a social media brand than to acquire the kind of contacts and normally inherited wealth necessary for a traditional political run.
Yes, I guess so. I guess it's more democratic, but it depends. I mean, I'm not sure that's exactly the way things are going. We heard about Oprah Winfrey being the next candidate for whatever party against Trump in 3 years. I mean, it's not going to be, you know, the Joe from the street who's going to be president. Although, yes, some say that everyone can be president at the moment. But I mean, is it really the road America wants to go to? Basically, they've opened their presidency to someone who didn't have any experience in politics, and most of them are biting their nails now. So will there be kind of a wish to go back to the old-fashioned politician, perhaps more women than men, something like that, but more old-fashioned politics, old-fashioned candidate and old-fashioned way of doing politics. Obama was the one who really opened up the social media and the internet to the campaign, and he did quite effectively. Perhaps the Twitter thing shows that everybody giving its opinion means that it's good everybody gives its opinion, but if the politician is weak enough to try and just want to cut the vote and the opinion of the social media, that's when it becomes a problem. So there has to be a reflection on this kind of democratic way of doing politics before the next presidentials.
Alistair, UK politicians are kind of oddly terrible at social media, with some exceptions. So Jeremy Corbyn and Nigel Farage are way out in front, with 1.7 million and 1.12 million followers respectively. Next on the list is Theresa May, with 460,000 followers, which is quite... You could view that as quite pitiful for the leader of a major country. Why is that the case?
Well, I think Jeremy Corbyn's got nothing to do with probably what he has to say on Twitter, but more to do with the just general aura that follows Jeremy Corbyn around. So I'm just looking again at my phone. I mean, number 10 Gov, which is the official Twitter account of the British Prime Minister, whoever is in office, has 5.5 million followers. So I suppose Theresa May, if she was sat here, would argue that
they should count in her favour.
Through that, they should count in her favour. But in so much that your point is that she did not come to office herself as she was, as a former Home Secretary, with a big Twitter following. I don't know, politicians just get it wrong. But then, I mean, has Trump got it right? But then Trump was not a politician. Hillary Clinton has a big Twitter following. But then, you know, she has a far bigger country in which she was Secretary of State within, as opposed to Britain. I just think British politicians took a long time to grasp things like Twitter and social media, and they're getting around to it, but getting around to it slowly.
Something we can all look forward to, no doubt.
Maybe, yeah.
Finally, on today's show, last summer, a few days after a state of emergency was declared for New York City's creaking subway system, the Metropolitan Transportation Authority announced a competition. The Genius Transit Challenge sought, in the agency's own words, to harvest innovative solutions to modernise and improve the reliability of the New York City subway system. After a long judging process, 438 entries have been whittled down to 19 across three categories. The finalists range from engineering giant Arup to a commercial litigator who lives on the Upper East Side and has some bright ideas. Now, in light of recent elections, the value of harnessing the wisdom of the crowd has a rather large question mark hanging over it. I wonder, does this contest point a way forward? Marie, should there be more competitions like this to get good ideas for public projects? It's already really common in fields like architecture, which is, you know, has very public effects, even when it's a private company doing it.
I want to say, why not? Because people can have good ideas. I mean, everybody has an opinion on the subway. I guess you ask every New Yorker, what do you think about the subway? They will have an idea. And there's one in, I don't know, a million who might have a walkable idea. So why not start from, you know, from the source and then try and work it out with professional afterwards? That's the way it's being done after the idea is being ringed, that I'm not sure I understand from this new concept. But yes, why not? Maybe it will help people, perhaps in France in particular, it will help people feel less that they should complain all the time, because they might, you know, put their ideas to good use.
Well, that kind of leads on to my next question. Alistair, do you think populations might feel a greater sense of control if there were more direct democratic initiatives and transparent competitions pertaining to at least local government decisions?
I think this is a brilliant idea. I mean, at the end of the day, any well-run company will always ask its employees, right from the top to the very bottom, if you've got any great ideas, then come forward with them. I mean, I work for Sky, and quite regularly you get emails or stuff on the internet saying, if you've got a good idea for a TV programme, let us know. Normally there's an incentive attached to it if ever it goes into production. And I think that if you've got a public body, in this case the New York Subway, that needs a solution, throw it open. I mean, New York is full of talented, bright minds. Who knows what you might get? Maybe it will come from a standard company, but like this, perhaps it might come from an individual who's hit the nail on the head.
Marie, finally, and very briefly, is it not slightly disconcerting that one of the most important metropolitan transport authorities in the world had to crowdsource ideas? Do we not want to believe that they're on top of it already?
Well, yes, but they are not. I mean, I've been to New York 4 years ago, and it was so complicated to understand which train stopped at which stations. The idea that this guy is putting forward doesn't seem very easy as well. 10 carriages, 6 stopping all the time, 4 stopping one station and not the other one. Seems a bit complicated. But, I mean, they don't have it. I mean, might as well just say, we don't have it, help us.
Well, on that note, it brings us to the end of today's show. Marie Bion and Alistair Bunkle, thanks very much for joining us here at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland and Carlotta Ribello. Research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Katy Mendoza. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. That's at 1800 London time. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan. Goodbye.